The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Hello, listeners. As a regular talker, I find silence interminable. Sometimes here's a little glimpse behind the scenes of the EMS Educast. We often start with a long pause, which helps in the audio editing for this show. And Rob might say, you know, we need 3 seconds or 5 seconds of pause so he can find in the recording of the show where we actually started talking. And I find myself staring at the computer screen thinking, oh my gosh, it must have been 15 minutes already. It's been so long. Rob, how did I do on 5 seconds?
I'm not sure. I fell asleep.
What?
I'm a power napper. So that was good. It was very good. For a chatty bunch like us, it's painful to be quiet that long.
Yeah, it sure is. You know, as one of the areas I watch lots and lots of educators fail is, or struggle, I don't know if they fail, but struggle is when they say to their audience, do you have any questions? When really they should be saying, what questions do you have? But they say, do you have any questions? And then that nanosecond of silence, you can just watch every uncomfortable fiber in their body seize up with that sort of thought of this dead air. And with the sort of great perseverance I've gotten, so I can actually count to 10 slowly and quietly to give people a chance to formulate a question.
That's a good point. We talk about endings at conferences too, the way people wrap up. And I found there are those who wrap up with a sort of a TED Talk type call to action, or
right,
they a closing statement, and then they allow for applause, and then they ask for questions, which I think is the right way to approach it. And then there are those who come to the end and without sort of having any grand finale, just stop at the end of their sentence and say, does anyone have any questions? And then there's, like you said, an awkward pause, and then a thank you, and then an awkward applause.
Right. Yeah. Well, speaking of awkward pauses, I think Bill Toon has joined us again. Bill?
I'm here.
Yeah. You keep dropping in and out of these calls. I'm not sure what's going on with the internet. Aren't you in Kansas City where there's now like Google Fiber Miracle Internet Service? Which,
I think that's a no.
Yeah.
Another awkward pause.
Yeah, so we for sure have confirmed that Bill does not have Miracle Google Magic Internet Service. But we do have our good friend Art Zia back on the EMS Educast. Art, welcome back to the show.
Hi, and thanks for having me. And hi, everyone.
And so since we've been mentioning awkward pauses and how conference presentations might end, Rob kind of captured some different variations there. Do you have a favorite or a personal that you try to end a presentation with?
Oh, I was just nodding my head vigorously that I was guilty of the second one, because I'll just go and go and go and then suddenly lose track of time and then, oh, look at the time, got to stop. And that usually means a very quick wrap up and then the question, are there any questions? And if you have any questions, come and see me after, the presentation ends. And I know, especially in the large trade shows, I usually try to get off the stage quickly because somebody else is coming right behind me typically. So I try to get off the stage quickly and then try to answer people's questions off to the side. And I try to do it that way.
I think the worst is when you talk to your slides and then the last slide suddenly comes up and you realize, oh, it's the end, right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Yep, that's it.
Disastrous.
Well, I'm sure somebody's busy working on an app that would like take control of the speaker's slides and reorder them, or pop up sort of like if enough people in the room voted or something, that suddenly a slide would come up and say, "The end. You're finished."
That would work. You need like every band ends with a big drum roll and then slamming guitar chords, and a jump up, with landing on the last guitar chord. That's what you need, something like that.
Okay, I'm on it. Wild Stallions, we'll do it. Angel, okay. Burba, what sort of flourish, rock and roll type flourish, do you end your conference presentations or classroom lectures with?
You know, it was funny because when I was listening to you all describe this, I've actually found myself a lot of times, I don't necessarily like to talk the whole time. And so a lot of times what I'll try to do is some sort of a topic where I can actually work an application piece in and they can get into small groups and things like that. And that's sort of my favorite way of presenting. But then what I found in doing that is I always lose the opportunity to have the ta-da, thank you very much, and, round of applause and all this, because it usually ends with, I usually have finished the talk, in an hour talk, I finished it at 30, 35 minutes or whatever, and then it's activity the rest of the time. And then it would just be kind of self-serving to re-clean everybody just so they could give me a round of applause. So I don't usually get applause.
Okay, well, you got to think of some dynamite flourish, some reason to bring them back together.
But you are a true educator. I mean, that is the mark of someone who truly has their audience thinking and chatting, and that's far superior to what most of us do, I think.
Oh, Rob, thanks.
Applause, schmalaz.
Yeah. Every once in a while, though, I just like to go, ta-da!
Yeah.
I teach live online using Blackboard Collaborate, and there's a little emoticon that's applause. I get more emoticon applause than I do real applause.
Okay.
I love teaching online. It's so awesome.
Yeah, that sort of instant click. Maybe some polling software could give you that same type of feedback. Mm. I think there, Ram Duckworth, I've seen him talk about this, about finishing with some call to action. Something at the end where you draw together whatever couple of key points that you had, and then make some very obvious call to action.
Save the whales.
Specific. Save the whales are so long and thanks for all the fish, but more along the lines of something very actionable. Where if you see that person again, you can ask him.
I seem to remember that kind of being the topic of one of your educasts a while back, where you were talking about that, and you were talking about how you're sort of preaching to the choir, and that isn't necessarily a good presentation. It's where you've stirred people up and caused controversy and got them really thinking that you've done a good job. So I kind of remember that.
Well, good. We're glad you're listening, Angel. So Angel's back, and Art is joining this time to follow up on that the call we had recently. Did I lose all of you?
No.
Okay.
No, we're here.
Gosh.
Just Bill.
Yeah, I've got crazy stuff going on.
Oh, we got an echo at Art's end.
Yep. Okay, let me go mute again and try coming back on.
Okay.
All right, so the thing that we're hoping to talk about is just more along the lines of how we... Art, you're still echoing. Okay. I think we got you muted this time. So the topic a couple weeks ago was just the bringing in new EMS instructors and how we welcome people into the program. We onboard them, help them come up to speed, and Angel and Dan Limmer were part of that conversation. And Art wasn't able to join us at that time, but you're here tonight. And what can you tell us about how somebody joins your program as an instructor, and what you do to bring them along from newbie instructor to somebody that's competent and can lead a class on their own?
That's a good question. So the I'm actually going through sort of a change in process right now, but I can explain sort of the original piece, which was at our college we have different levels of instructors, and I think what most of us would call skills instructors. In my college, we call them professional experts. And these folks, we can bring in as many of these folks as we wish to either help out specifically with some of the topic structures or to, for the most of the time, teach in the lab in small group exercises. And in those situations, it's a pretty sort of low-end start in terms of people just have to supply a resume and a letter of interest. And we have sort of open calls once a year to try to bring people in. I had created a structure where we took students through, I'm sorry, instructor candidates through an orientation phase, and then we had them sign into classes to teach. But my job was to try to make sure that the teaching pool for that particular day was balanced. There have been times where it's been really helpful to have to be able to double up on instructors. And I think that sort of leads into where we've sort of have evolved into. It's one of the things about having new instructors on board. I was listening to last week's podcast on this, and I think somebody was saying, you know, how tenuous it can be that you don't really want your new instructors to jump in and swim or try to swim at least without at least some help and some mentoring. And that's really tough if you're sort of the primary instructor and you're the lab coordinator and you're also the lab, fetch it guy and sort of pulled in every which way. And it's hard to kind of stay with a new instructor to help mentor them while they teach. So this past semester, we actually did not hire new instructors at that particular level. And instead, we have been starting to bring in folks that have been out of their primary training program about 1 to 2 years, not coincidentally coming from now my first and second paramedic program that I taught here at the college. And they're coming in on a voluntary basis to help out with some very specific skills acquisition or skills evaluation. I'm able to pair those folks with experienced instructors so that they end up teaching alongside with someone at least a couple of times. And the directions given to the experienced instructor is, I'd like you to model some behavior, provide some input, and have this other person, start to take over some of the teaching while you're standing, next to them and then behind them and going through that process. It's very labor intensive, but it helps in a couple of different avenues. One, the new instructor doesn't feel completely out there on their own and trying to figure it out. And it also has generated some real interest from some of the experienced instructors because they get to do some mentoring and some tutoring and share that part of their practice, the teaching part of the practice, which I don't think they had been asked to do before. And so it's generated some real interest from that aspect.
Art, did I hear you correctly say you bring in instructors on a volunteer basis?
It's starting to evolve that way. And I have to say that it hasn't been by design, to be absolutely honest. I've now in my college, I'm 3 years in. So this is my third program, second one that I'm running as a director. At the college, we have sort of this unofficial rule that you have to have at least 2 years of field experience before you can teach at the college at any particular level at the EMS program. So during those 2 years, what we used to do is just say, go away and then come back in 2 years if you're still interested in teaching. Mm-hmm. And I've seen in my last two classes a handful of students in each one that basically had either explicitly expressed an interest in teaching, or I felt that they had a lot of the affect, the personality to be a great teacher. You know, the patience, the ability to see multiple sides, the ability to be neutral and not try to stamp a meeting me out of someone, that type of personality. And so over the last 3 or 4 months, I've been asking people on a one-on-one basis to come on in. We can provide them continuing education. And so for California, we're allowed to do that. To a certain number of hours. And so that's all I can offer them. And I'm very upfront with them in terms of doing that. But what I'm getting are people that are interested. They're interested in teaching. A lot of times they liked what they saw when they were students and want to sort of learn more about that piece. And it's been very interesting.
I'm going to try to dial Bill up, so you might hear the phone ringing while we try to get him on.
I'm just curious, Angel, do you do that as well at your college? Are you able to bring on volunteers?
Yes, we do. And often, another thing that we do actually with our students who are in the program, our paramedic students, they tutor EMT students. And some of that is done as community service. They have a certain amount of community service projects and hours they have to give. But also then we have new graduates who often want to come back. And it's sort of a nice way of auditioning them without all of the stress of them actually applying for a job and being rejected or thinking they're going to be rejected because they feel like they're not worthy or whatever. It's sort of a way of them to kind of get their foot back in the door again and to start, you know, the mentoring process for them to become instructors. So yeah, we do it, not to the degree that Art, it sounds like Art is doing it, but yes, absolutely. We do that.
That's great. That's especially great when you have people who genuinely want to teach, but perhaps they don't have quite the amount of experience that the college likes to see.
Right. Yeah. You know, and the trick is to have the balance. Certainly, you know, what I wouldn't want to see is if I have 5 instructors here that only one of them has experience, both as a field provider as well as an instructor. That wouldn't be fair to the current students that are there. But certainly, we're starting to see this sort of mix of both existing experienced instructors as well as new folks who are a little bit, you know, sort of the diamonds in the rough in terms of teachers and diamond in the rough in terms of experience, but has all of the right affect necessary to really, you know, have the potential to do a great job inside the classroom. And so pairing them with somebody is really helpful.
How do you say thanks but no thanks to somebody that's interested, but you don't think they've got the right skill set to do it well, or maybe the interest in getting better?
It's probably at a couple different levels. I have had some frank discussions. The most pleasant ones are the ones in where both of us feel that it's not a good fit. And so the instructor candidate self-selects and says, yeah, I thought it would be for me, but it's a lot more work than I thought it would be. Or it's just, you know, I see the world more in black and white, and it's hard for me to see in shades of gray. So those are probably the easier conversations to have. The harder ones are, even when they're volunteering, I'd like to try to give them at least the benefit of the doubt. And so we have the longer conversation of, here are the things that went great this time. Here's some of the things that you need to work on. So the next time you come back, let's focus on these particular areas. And I'm seeing that now. I mean, I definitely have a couple of folks who are totally wanting to do it, but are, you know, taking a little bit longer to develop the skill set. And so I'm a little bit more careful when I schedule them in. I take a look at the entire instructor pool for the day to see, well, would this be, you know, with this person coming in to volunteer, will this work? If it doesn't work, I ask them not to come. That's it's relatively easy to do if they're volunteering. So that's the case. The worst ones are the ones that the worst conversations are the ones that people feel like they're doing particularly well, and they may be doing okay, but not in the program philosophy that I'm trying to foster within the academy. And so for those folks, if they don't respond kindly to constructive criticism, we just stop using them.
We typically will start people in a role where there's a great deal of mentoring and oversight. So we might start them with in a tutoring, and before they have their first tutoring session with the student, we've debriefed them and sort of talked about where we think problems lie with the student. And then after they've done the tutoring session, then we sit them down and we'll kind of pick their brain about, well, where did you see the problems and what's your sense of whatever deficits the student might have or what are some of their strengths? And so we start kind of building from that perspective. And then the other thing that we'll do is we'll bring people in to do skills training, skills practice, skills testing even, as they become more comfortable. But the first few times they do this, they're shadowed. We would never just throw them to the wolves and have them be by themselves. They have to be with another instructor who's already a well-established member of the program. So we kind of threw them into it.
Even in the theory classes? Or are we talking about labs?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
No, theory as well. Wow. I mean, theory is a little harder because actually what's been happening is I have a lot of people who are very comfortable with the skills and the skill part. And frankly, that doesn't require much prep either. You know, you can sort of get a list of skills. If you're a fairly strong clinician, you just get a list of skills and you walk in the door and you're ready to go. It's the theory parts where it's been more difficult to find faculty because they don't necessarily want to develop a lesson plan, even though we've got a lot of canned things we offer them. They don't necessarily want to stand up in front of the students and have that vulnerability that they think they're going to have with this the lack of knowledge that they think they might have, or they're fearful.
When you bring somebody in for tutoring sessions, is there specific topics that they're supposed to work on, or is it just the student saying, this is what I'm struggling with?
Yeah, when students come in to tutor, part of the process, they've formally signed up with the Office of Student Services in the college.
Okay.
And their tuition that they pay, based on their tuition, they are entitled to a certain amount of hours of tutoring based on their credit load. Okay. So for, a 12-credit semester, you could have 2 or 3 hours a week of free tutoring.
All right.
And so they're allowed that. But it's a fairly controlled process from the perspective of the student support services. But this, we instruct the students and the tutors, actually, when the student comes in for tutoring, they're not just sitting down at the desk and repeating the instructional session over again. They need to bring their workbook. They need to bring, several questions that they have. And it has to be a give and take. We tell instructors, actually, that if the student is unprepared and is just kind of sitting there waiting, expecting to be a sponge, that the session should probably not go the full amount of time because the students have to contribute.
Huh, that's a neat thing. And just in sort of the age of YouTube, it's reassuring to know that people still use actual other humans face-to-face to tutor or help them, show them things. I've been watching a bunch of Khan Academy videos recently and thinking, you sort of have a always available tutor at your fingertips, but, the chance to be able to actually ask somebody questions and have a dynamic conversation about what you want to learn more about or get better at, there's real opportunity there.
Yeah, that's really interesting I've really had to encourage the students in this class to seek tutoring. It wasn't enough for me to post office hours this time. As opposed to my two previous classes, if I posted them, I would get people to sign up, and I knew who was going to be coming on a regular basis. It took a good month before students started to show up at my door for office hours. And I'm not sure why. It's now to the point where I have students that do come in regularly, but I do a much more active in chasing people into off hours now, as opposed to before, I just sort of waited for people to show. This time, because I was tracking their grades and doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing and figuring out that some people were getting into trouble pretty early, that I really had to get them kicking and screaming to get into the office hour. And but it works. It certainly has worked in terms of getting the students up to speed and getting them so they can do well inside the classroom. We just had a big exam today, so I'm still sort of feeling pretty good about it because this was the cardiology component. And out of 19 students, we had only one retest to do, which is far better than what we've had in the last two semesters, last two classes.
Do you think in Angel's situation where it sounded like paramedics can tutor EMTs, do you think that, I guess, narrower gap in knowledge makes it easier for somebody to seek out help rather than going, you know, their instructor? There's a much bigger gap between what the student knows and what the instructor knows.
You mean the instructors who are paramedics or EM?
Well, just the the situation where Angel mentioned she's got almost a peer tutoring situation versus a professor student office hours situation.
Yeah, we actually have a formalized structure with every academy. So whether you're in EMR or EMT or paramedic, you have a specific set number of mentoring hours that you have to deliver as part of your course load. And for the paramedics, they have 16 hours per semester that they sign up for. And some of the mentoring hours is helping to staff skill stations for the EMT courses or to evaluate their performance. So there's a lot of interaction between our students from paramedic to EMT to EMR, and there's a lot of informal tutoring that goes on between the three different groups. It's not a bad idea at all. What we always try to at least let the EMT and the EMR students know is to always, you know, check to see if something doesn't sound right, you know, definitely take a look and research it a little bit rather than taking things at face value.
What I find go ahead.
No, I just I'm listening to this part of the conversation, but I remember back when I was doing primary education, what I would do with students is that we had regular conferences, so they had no choice. There was a one-on-one opportunity for them to come in, and we went through their file, you know, head to toe. They initialed everything that was in their file. And it was a great opportunity to talk to them and to discuss weaknesses and then put together a plan for them. And I found that being much more active about that allowed me to give them that opportunity. And then based upon that end of that discussion, you know, right there, I'd spin around on the computer and I'd write up what we had just agreed upon, and everyone would sign it and would go into their file and they'd get a copy of it. And I just found that to be a really worthwhile way to get people moving along. I do like, though, the idea of taking people in higher-level programs, though, and helping them mentor, you know, previous classes before them, you know, as an assistant, if you want to call them. I think there's a lot of value in that, and it's sort of the old principle, see one, do one, teach one.
What we used to do in the program regarding tutoring is during orientation, which is our first week of the program, I would have this handout that would go to all the students, and basically the handout would state that the students understand that this is a huge commitment type of a program, and that, you know, that, and we outline the parameters of what gets somebody in a probationary status, and, you know, we're a kind of a couple strikes and you're out program, but what those strikes are and all those sorts of things. And one of the things we would have them do is sign this document that states that they clearly understand that they are obligated to seek tutoring anytime their grades fall below a certain point, and, you know, that we're going to certainly provide tutoring for them, but they're going to seek it and they're going to participate in it. And of course, every student signs this document, and it always went in the files. But then what happens is, as they start floundering and they start, you know, their performance starts dropping, we would go to the students and we would remind them, you need to sign up for tutoring, you need to start tutoring. And they just aren't following up on it. And so then my boss, the department chair, and I had a conversation about this on a couple of occasions, because we would always call this mandatory tutoring. And she would turn around and say, well, what's the consequence if you don't tutor? And of course, the consequence is your grades don't improve and then you fail out. But because there was no tracking of this per se and no immediate, you know, grade reductions or no penalties attached to this, she really felt like this isn't something that we can necessarily enforce. And I'm thinking, well, the students have, this is a handshake. They've agreed, you know, and they've given me their word that they're going to do this. And isn't that good enough? And, you know, apparently it's not, because we just don't do that anymore. But then what I have happen is the students won't, they will come to me, you know, 2 seconds after class ends, and three or four of them will want to meet with me right then and there. And I don't have a problem necessarily meeting with them, but I will cue them up and I'll say, okay, you know, you get 15 minutes and then you're going to come back and you've got a half hour because you want to go over the test or whatever. And the one that's in that second spot won't hang around, because they've got other things to do. And so they can't wait 15 minutes for the person that's in front of them. And so then they don't come back. And then it's like, well, and then later on when they, you know, fail out of the program or whatever, and we're counseling with them, it's like, well, I knew I was failing, but I didn't want to bother you. And so it's all this really weird dynamic going on.
Yeah. And I think it's definitely a challenge that exists trying to get students to engage, because I think there is a certain degree of an intimidation thing. And I did a very similar thing, as you know, there was the student policies, everyone reviewed it, everyone signed for it. And I had gotten not myself personally, but the program had been taken to a small claims court by students that had failed, you know, because the amount of money fit within small claims. And they would make all sorts of claims that they weren't aware and they weren't notified. And, you know, all I had to do was bring out their file and show all the letters and all their signatures and everything. And the judge would say, you're sorry, you know.
Right.
And off it went. But it was my level of documentation had to get to prevent that from happening had to be very high. And it was labor intensive, as I'm sure you know, and I was a one-person program. You know, I had never took more than 16 or 20 students in, and worked with them for 12 months, and had adjuncts that would be in, but I was the only full-time person, so it was very labor-intensive.
Right.
When's a good time when you have a new instructor or somebody, I guess, that's sort of moving up through to have them go off to, say, the state instructor coordinator conference, or to take the NIMSE instructor level 1 course? Like, what are some, I guess, when's somebody ready to do that and make that sort of next commitment from helping out as an adjunct and then every now and then to that formalized instructor training?
Oh, that's the big C word now, isn't it?
The for coordinator.
Competency.
Commitment.
Oh. Both.
Yeah. I mean, I think to recommend somebody to go is, if I recommend somebody to go take the course, like the NIMSE course, for example, because I know how much of a commitment that can be. I would recommend it to somebody once that they have shown that they are committed to teaching, that it becomes part of their, you know, EMS DNA. Once that process starts to happen, and I think, and that varies from person to person. We just had one person who just started teaching, but is so in love with the concept that she's evolving really rapidly. I mean, this is the person that sort of looks at the teaching journals now, and looks at the teaching research and asks questions about that. Hey, you know, I saw this. I'm like, wow, that's really cool. I didn't even think about looking for that. You know, she was a very easy recommendation to go. You need to go get this. I think you're going to get so much out of it that it'll be totally worth the investment for you to go. So I think it's, for me, it's the commitment piece. Once you're committed to going through that process.
What do you think, Angel?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Art.
Rob, do you have similar type things in Ontario where people have to go off to some sort of provincial instructor school?
They do it right at the community college. We have a teaching and training of adults, and we have a, when we hire on new faculty, they go through a semester-long adult education / orientation process. So they're basically in school once a week. So it's pretty formalized across the community colleges. You know, some of my Canadian colleagues are trying to promote the NAMC instructor training courses here in Canada, but I don't think they'll ever catch on because we just do it formally in the college and university setting here.
Right.
Yeah.
I have another question, and you know, in the news again, at least here in the States, we've got this situation with the Miami Dolphins football team and what appears to be some sort of bullying and hazing and intimidation in the workplace. And the connection with EMS is I've sometimes experienced people that come back as helpers or adjunct faculty and then want to make sure everyone experiences something that they experience. And I'm thinking about the, you know, you get somebody all strapped to the backboard and then you carry them down and you set them up in the bathroom, or you just walk out of the room when, you know, somebody's immobilized like that. And, or even the sort of like, hey, it's, well, let's all go out for beers. That's what we always did when I was in paramedic classes. After class, we'd all go out. Let's all go out. And, how do you, I guess, you know, Art, you're bringing in people that, you know, you just had in class very recently, so you helped shape their experience, but how do you sort of keep people out of those traditions or steer them away to a different type of culture?
Oh, just say no. That's usually a start. But they have the instructors for the paramedic academy at least have a very clear set of guidelines. I send them out every time that I put out the word for instructors. So I probably once a month send out an email to folks to say, hey, the next month, next 2 months schedule are up. Go ahead and sign up at the online scheduling tool. And by the way, here are the rules. And that's always attached to every single email. And the rules are pretty clear. You know, you will show up in clothes, and you'll show up in something that looks like a uniform because we expect our students to be that. And we just sort of go down that list. It had its intended effect. Some people thought I was real stick in the mud, and they stopped teaching. And it was just fine that was the case.
Yeah,
I'm quite sure you missed them. You missed them dearly, right?
I think it was just a mutual parting.
Yeah.
And we'll just leave it at that. And and even with the new instructors, because you know people still show up in beach shorts and flip flops, and I like, you know, I can't have you do this. Do you have your uniform in your car at least? Because I know that most of them carry their uniforms or a pair of boots, work boots or something in the trunk of their car. And so if worse comes to worse, I have them go back into their work uniform and then teach. That usually only happens to happen once. And then after that, that stops. But I think it is. It's a very active process of just saying this is not the philosophy of the program. It might have been in the past, but it isn't now.
Yeah.
And conform. Either you conform or you don't, you know. You can teach somewhere else. It's not that they're doing a bad thing necessarily. I mean, some of these folks were really good teachers as far as I could tell, but they had a clear sense of what they felt the program was about. And that was really in conflict with the philosophy I was trying to generate.
I remember two or three classes ago, there was some bullying incident that occurred somewhere. It was, I think it was one of those situations where a teenager was bullied and then committed suicide or something, but it was something that was big and when it happened. And I remember we talked about it in class. We talked about it in both our paramedic and our EMT classes. And it was really interesting to hear the students' perspective on it, because quite a few of the students felt that a certain amount of the hazing type things that are going on, the fraternity level of, you know, the pranking and those sorts of things, felt like it was perfectly acceptable, reasonable, normal, and something that, you know, within the culture of the rescue squad or the fire department or the ambulance service, it was just something that you did as a rite of passage, and you had it done to you, and then the next green guy that walked in the door had it done to them. And it was some really thought-provoking conversations. That, you know, a lot of the kids weren't buying it. You know, we were selling it and they weren't buying it, and they're going to continue doing it. And that's just the way it is in their culture.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Rob, I've been talking a lot here. What else is on your mind?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm at a loss.
All right.
I'm trying to think of how to steer us back on you know, helping new educators evolve. And, you know, is there anything other than orientations and coming into the classroom and directing them to take an instructor course that can guide them along or prepare them for the workload? I'm just thinking, I have... Right now, this is the time in our semester, I have 200 assignments to mark, a little over 100 of which are essays, which take me about an hour to mark a piece, and it's pretty staggering. And wow. And sometimes you get people who are really educators or have great potential, and then they see what kind of work's involved every semester, and it scares the bejeebers out of them, and before you know it, they're gone. Or they're looking to teach clinical or lab because they just can't handle the workload of teaching theory classes. So just wondering what your thoughts are on that. And maybe we'll start with Art.
Well, that's a good question. I think that there are some things that, and I think it probably does come back to that whole commitment idea. I'm thinking of the same instructor who really is evolving very quickly as an instructor. And, you know, she's already asked about if she could possibly do some of the lectures and or do some parts of a presentation, part of a day, like an hour's worth or something to that effect. And I'm considering doing that, although I'm a little bit more hesitant to do so. In my head, I'm a little bit more compartmentalized. I want her to develop more competencies in the skill acquisition part. And that's just me, my myopia on that. Part of it is also some external constraints. In the college where I teach, I can have guest speakers come in, but I can't pay them to do that. In the lecture aspect, it's generally handled by an adjunct faculty or a full-time faculty. And to achieve adjunct here at the college takes more effort in terms of having a degree and going through a much more formalized process. So I have less control over that than in the instructor pool that sort of touches the students on an everyday basis in the lab.
That must be a source of frustration.
A little bit at times. Mm-hmm. But it's all for the right reasons that happens. You know, so for us, adjuncts have the same right to assignment right to load as a full-time faculty does. And so and we are a state program. And so if we are going to bring on adjuncts, we really do want to bring on the right people. And so it is a much more drawn out process, frustrating as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My situation is vastly different. Actually, we have certain ratios of full-time to part-time that are supposed to be maintained for the colleges that are, you know, state mandates and things like that. And our college is very out of balance. We're well under the 50-50 ratio of full-time to adjuncts. And in my program, I don't even hire adjuncts. So I hire, well, I am hiring some adjuncts, but I mainly hire part-time hourly who aren't even added into that balance. So I've got two or three people that will teach a couple of credits on the adjunct side. And then the majority of my workforce is part-time hourly. And the college hardly budgets. I mean, every year I've been $40,000 to $50,000 over budget just with my part-time hourly salary budgets. So, and we did, you know, several years ago, the advisory board and the main parts of the program, we all kind of came together and came up with this like 5-year plan for staffing and all this kind of stuff. And we're not anywhere near it. I have two, including myself, we have two full-time faculty and one full-time staff, and we've got over 100 students every semester. So it's so out of balance right now. And the thing is, these positions aren't available, so I can't even hire. You know, the college we're having exponential growth in the college, and we may, you will grow by 1,000 students, 1,000 full-time every year in the college, and they might hire 3 new full-time faculty people. You know, it's just the ratios are way off, and it's everybody's working double, triple time, and it's just really, really difficult.
And that seems to be universal right across all borders, countries, colleges.
Yeah. Well, I'm mad as heck, and I don't want to take it anymore.
Sounds like a Dixie Chick song.
Gosh. Well, we are nearing the end of our hour, and maybe each of us have opportunity for a final thought or a question on the topic, and then we'll wrap up if anyone has recommendations or things they want to share with listeners. Bill, you've been quiet for a while. Any final thoughts from you or questions?
No, I think it's very important when you do bring someone in, you bring in a new instructor, that you start small and you teach with them, particularly in the lab type stuff, and you just continue to progress. And that I think it's okay for someone to just want to do labs, small group teaching, versus someone who wants to stand up and teach the theory, because I think those are different skill sets that come along. And I like what Art said, is that sometimes naturally someone is just ready and they're interested and they just want to learn more and more. And I think that if you can help get their cup to runneth over with knowledge, that's to their it's to their benefit. But I think that the challenge that EMS has in general here in the United States, for sure, is we have to do more and more to formalize the people that provide the education, regardless of the level that it's being done at, because we need, the way we can affect future patient care is by the quality of students that we turn out, and the quality of students that we turn out are very much based upon the quality of the instructor that they have that helps in their educational process.
Well said, Bill. Mm-hmm. Rob, do you have a final thought or a question?
I think I might have mentioned this in our last discussion, and you know, just listening to this conversation, this is such a great exchange of ideas and exchange of what people are doing in different places, and I think it would really be valuable for NAMC, for example, to organize some kind of forum where this discussion can take place and more formally put some ideas down, even a sort of rubric looking at best practices for orientation of new staff, theory, clinical, lab. I think that would be interesting further discussion.
Well, and I'm really struck by this idea that Angel shared of paramedic students tutoring EMT students, and I think increasingly paramedics are going to be asked as part of the care they provide in their communities to do more instruction to patients and families, whether it be chronic disease management or medication compliance or prevention of worsening illness or injury. I think so opportunities that you have to practice teaching in your role as a patient care provider, I think can only assist you as you move out into the career as a paramedic. So I think that's a really neat idea you've shared, Angel, and one that I hadn't heard of before. Angel, do you have a final thought or idea on the topic at hand to share?
Yeah, I think just to kind of build off of what Rob said, I really would love to see a program director workshop or something along those lines that really it does focus on these issues. And I'd mentioned to a couple of you in an email about, you know, even about the soft skills that we're now being required to teach, you know, everything, the putting in ET tubes and all those kind of things are classified as hard skills. But in the literature on education and leadership and things like that, they talk about the soft skills, and those are all of the affectively based, but also communication and thinking, and you know, conflict resolution and death notification. I mean, there's just so many aspects of what are considered soft skills that are not being brought into the curricula, but yet the surveys that are coming back from employers and things like that, you know, it's starting to creep into those employer surveys about why aren't students being taught these things. And I think that there's a whole opportunity there to start that conversation with program directors and with faculty and just to kind of get that moving along as well.
Thanks for that, Angel. Art, do you have a final thought to share on the topic?
Well, it was just something that you had just mentioned, Greg, in terms of we're kind of going through this transition period where we're starting to look at community paramedicine and what that really means. And that is another set of information that's coming that is going to be fairly foreign to a lot of people, especially educators. And it brings up the issue of, can educators, or it's not really a question, it's really more of a call that educators have to understand that they can't be teaching in the past, that they always have to be teaching with an eye toward the future, that there's things that are going to evolve rather quickly in terms of, like in this case, community paramedicine. And my guess will be that there was not going to be a whole lot of educators out there who are going to be able to incorporate that type of information with any sense of confidence into curriculum if their region is involved with such a change in the practice.
Agreed.
Something else to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's
something to be hopeful about, Rob.
Right.
And you know, I think that era, Art, of the basic educator at the paramedic level has to be versed in the entire curricula, soup to nuts. I think that that's going away.
Yeah,
and
I think
we're specializing now. And, you know, you've got your flair areas and I've got mine. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I know that's it's the I worry about.
What's that?
That's a bad joke. Never mind.
Okay.
Disregard.
All right. Well, we'll edit that out. So we like to end the show with an endorsement or a recommendation, something you want to share with listeners and let other people know about. And usually I remember to prompt our guests about that before the show starts. In this situation, I totally forgot about that. So if you haven't prepared anything, you can take a pass. Otherwise, Rob, did you prepare something?
I did. I have an app to recommend.
Oh, great.
I know this comes as a shock to our listeners that I have an app to recommend. People probably wondered, do I have anything else to contribute to this conversation? So I found this app. It's a great app. It's called Splashtop. And I'm not sure if it's available for Android or other smart devices, but it is available for iOS. And it is available for Windows. I should add that. And it's a remote device that enables you to basically control, let's say you're using a Windows-based PowerPoint, you can control it from your iPad while walking around the classroom. And it's for you to put an overlay on top of your PowerPoint so you can draw on it using a stylus or using your finger from your iPad. And I just started playing with it, and it's quite nice.
Cool.
What was the name of that app again? I missed it.
It's called Splashtop, and I'll fire off a link to you.
Okay, Splashtop. Yeah, I've started to see more and more people using that kind of app-based thing, and you know, I feel like walking around with the iPad in my hand would be maybe too much to carry. But
see, I find the one thing I don't like doing in a classroom is writing on a chalkboard.
Yeah.
And so I really like to have an iPad in my hand and be able to draw an ECG or draw a heart or draw a pair of lungs or something, and just do it there instead of getting chalk all over my, because I look like I've been in a battlefield full of chalk soldiers. You know, at the end of a class, I've got chalk marks all over my shirt and my pants. And
well, we don't want you to look like you've had chalk dust torture. Bill, do you have anything you want to recommend or share?
Yes, and those people that are members of NAMSI should have received this already, but NAMSI sent out a notice from the National Emergency Medical Services Advisory Council asking for there to be comments on the breadth and the depth of issues updated for the EMS education agenda for the future. So if you go to the NEMSAC site, you can see the information related to that. So I want to really encourage people to go there and look and make their comments, you know, as requested. I think we missed these opportunities, and I know they're looking for the feedback. So jump on there and do that.
It's too bad they won't be changing scope of practice, because that's already changed.
That's what I was going to say too, Art. It was kind of interesting, the little caveat of, we're not going to change much, but...
Yeah, sorry, you missed the boat. It's the tail wagging the dog again.
Yes, it is.
We're right back to where we started, unfortunately.
Mm.
Don't let that prevent you from pushing and urging.
Maybe.
Yep. You betcha.
Yeah, Bill's point is taken.
Great. Angel, do you have something you would like to recommend?
I actually post, I'll get you the link for it. I don't know the name of it, but there was a really interesting TED talk today from a woman who is floating around on Facebook, and I actually shared it on my Facebook page. But really nice 8-minute inspirational, kind of made you think about why we're in education, and she pretty much focused on the communication, the interpersonal pieces, and how you really do inspire your students, and they're worthy, and it was just really a nice thing to watch, and so I'll get you that link so you can post it with the show.
Excellent. And if listeners want to connect with you, how can they get a hold of you?
I'm on Facebook, and they can also email me at aburba@msn.com.
Okay, great. Thank you for being part of the show again, Angel. We always appreciate having you. And Art, something you want to share or recommend?
I wasn't quite prepared for this, but there was something in the back of my mind. No worries. But the, you know, Rob, you're not the only one with apps. Keep crashing my phone because of the same reason. So, and you may have suggested this once before, it's the ECG rhythm and monitor simulator. It's made by Star CPR San Diego. Mm-hmm. I actually would recommend this for students. It gives them an opportunity to basically have an icon. It's not an icon, it's basically an interactive animation of a monitor defibrillator with a rhythm strip that appears in front of them, and it looks a lot like some of the software front ends for some of these simulator models, of which I won't name names, but the first letter starts with Lerdal, and
I love it.
It's yeah, well, you know. But in any case, I've had a couple of students who have downloaded it. It's just under $10. I think it's
Now that I'm looking at it, it's $12.99. So I think they feel like they've got a good thing going and have upped the price slightly. But it's really good that the students, some of the students have downloaded it onto their iPads, and they take turns testing each other through cardiology by running the cases, and then they get to work their way through a mega code using an iPad. So it seemed like it worked well. I talked to several different students, and they all seemed to like the game format of it. So that's one to recommend, and I'll send you the link on that.
Great. We'll look forward to putting that in the show notes as well. Art, if listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they reach you?
A couple different places. They can reach me through the EMS1 news site. It can be just art.sia@ems1.com. They can also reach me on Facebook as well. And my college address is acia@santarosa.edu.
All right. And it's a trick spelling. It's A-H-S-I-E-H.
Correct.
Santa Rosa. What'd you call it? SantaRosaCollege.com?
It's SantaRosa.edu.
Okay, .edu.
Yep.
Chris, well, what I just, like I mentioned earlier in the show, I've been watching lots and lots of YouTube videos recently. One of my longtime educator dreams is to have software where you can mash up the rest of the web content into a CE course. And I guess this is partially self-serving, but we've realized that dream here with new software called LearnEMS.com at CenterLearn, and it's something that's really, really exciting for me. And then the part of that that I've been getting to watch lots and lots of YouTube videos, and because there's some amazing stuff out there for EMS, EMTs, paramedics, EMS educators, and just, I think, a few reminders, like if you know, as you have opportunities to film, whether it be simulations or scenarios or practice things, landscape videos are always better than portrait videos. Students and instructors that are in uniforms versus street clothes look really sharp on video, and I think it reflects really well on the program. And then put a shout out for your program as you do the video. Let the world know where this is being filmed and where you're learning to become an EMT or paramedic or teaching EMTs and paramedics, because you're doing some really great stuff, and I'm having a lot of fun watching it. And I think I've mentioned this many, many years ago, but there is often you can find some great things that you don't get to see. Usually it's over before you get to the patient's side, and there's some really incredible seizure videos of patients, especially kids, having seizures that are available on YouTube. And so often we arrive in the postictal state for the patient, and maybe even the kid is doing relatively great, and we're puzzled why mom is freaking out. And so if you've never seen a small child having a seizure, go watch some seizure videos, and I think it can really maybe help you next time when mom is freaking out about the seizure her child just had, and now that child's sort of sitting on the floor giggling, and you're like, well, what's the big deal? So go watch some of those, and keep up the good work with the great content that you're posting, because there's great materials out there. So with that being said, thanks everyone for making this a great episode of the EMS Educast. We really appreciate it.